All right, this is the third in the series. We're going to talk about anxiety and how it affects us. Of course, no one has anxiety, so it's going to be a short lecture. Usually, anxiety affects the brain by turning it into mush, and that's pretty well it, guys, so thanks for coming. The first session was about story, and about our story and Holden's story, and then the second session was about change, how it affects our story. We did that. When did I do that? Yesterday? And talk about letting go and taking hold in the in-between time, so forth and so on. But also during the time of change, you also have anxiety. So I'm going to talk about anxiety, go through some stuff with you briefly on that, then we'll move into the brain, and then I have a little exercise. You don't have to pair up with anybody. You don't have to look at somebody for a minute. You don't have to change anything. You'll be able to do it just by sitting there, and I'll just show you how quickly your brain functions. So anxiety comes from the Latin angere, which means to cause pain by squeezing, right? So what other words come from this?
Anger.
Anybody else?
Anguish.
Anxious.
Anxious can. Anguish can. Angst.
Angina.
Angst. And angina. What's angina?
No. The heart.
There you go, the squeezing of the heart. So there's some characteristics about anxiety that you should be aware of. Oops, went backwards, sorry. Anxiety is natural. It's a basic human emotion. We all have it. It comes and goes, but we all have it. It is present in every person and affects all human relations. Communities, systems, whatever, you name it, you'll have anxiety. Anxiety helps us cope with life. Anxiety pushes us forward, okay? Anxiety will help us move on. You get anxious, you make a decision, I'm going to move on. Anxiety keeps us alert to potential change in the environment. Anxiety can force us to respond or it can inhibit us. And positively, I don't know if you can see that, anxiety can motivate us to change. It can arouse our consciousness. It can help us see things in a new way. Negatively, we become or feel stuck. Anxiety can actually freeze us. I mean, freeze, like you're not going to make a decision. You can't move on because of the anxiety. A key thing to remember when talking about or dealing with or looking at anxiety in people and in yourself is the fact that anxiety is very contagious. Okay, anxiety is very contagious. One person in a room gets very anxious, and before long, other people are starting to get anxious too. Okay. And there's three types of anxiety. One is ordinary anxiety. This is accompanies our daily life. This is what we experience the most, and every day we experience this. It comes to us when we might be late. We feel a little anxious when we can't find our cell phone, can't find our wallet, can't find our keys. It might be when we're packing or planning a trip. Going to work, maybe a little anxiety right there, and then you get halfway there, you forget your briefcase, or forget your phone, you forget whatever. You can't get the car started, your anxiety goes up. Okay? Those are your daily things. Daily things in anxiety. There's also acute anxiety, which is generated by a crisis or a trauma. And that could be anywhere from loss of a job, or the disruption of a relationship, major argument, going to the dentist or to the doctor, right? Which can also be ordinary anxiety. I mean, I get a little anxious going to the dentist, but I know nothing's going to happen. I'll get my teeth clean fine, you know? But for some, going to the dentist is really difficult, right? But not you people, of course. So acute anxiety, of course, pushes that up. You have the traffic ticket, you have the court summons, you have the red and blue lights flashing in your rearview mirror. Could also be a family death. The difference between acute and ordinary is acute is situational, and it is time-bound. In other words, you'll have it for a while, and then it'll be gone. The policeman will talk to you, take down your stuff, give you your ticket, and then it's over until you have to go to court and pay and all that sort of thing. So at first a person will loses control of their self during this little part of anxiety and is reactive to what's going on, but eventually they regain their composure, life can go on. And then you have chronic anxiety. It's habitual and can't be laid to rest unless professional help is sought. Okay, it is structured into the system or the relationship itself, or is perpetually present in someone. It just does not go away, and a slight change or a small issue can set it off. An example would be if you experienced a bad situation with a neighborhood dog when you were young. Now, maybe dogs in general aren't going to bother you, but maybe a German Shepherd, which that dog was, might bother you, even as an adult. It may not send you off the deep end, but you see a German Shepherd and you may want to cross the street because of what happened in the past, even though you know that's what it is. I don't know if I had acute or chronic anxiety from chickens, but I remember as a five-year-old being at my Aunt Ida's farm and the chickens came after me. And I don't know if you've ever been around chickens when they're outside, they just kind of come, and they start kind of merging in. They're doing this, they're coming at you. And as a five-year-old or six-year-old, I was able to climb a tree. I bet I was only about this far off the ground, but it was a low branch and I was up there. And I don't know how long, I felt like I sat there 3 days, but I probably did. But that sort of thing, I mean, I have a friend who talks about having a bad encounter as a child with a dog, and to this day, this person cannot be on the same side of the street when that type of dog, and he is now 75 years old, and this happened when he was about 10 or 11. Okay, so that's the chronic. Okay. Now there's three ways that we kind of handle or try to handle our anxiety, and one is emotional cutoff or distancing. Which means we isolate ourselves. We get in an anxious situation with people and we just withdraw. We distance ourselves. We cut them off. We cut ourselves off from them. It is a reactive process. It gives us time, or gives the individual time, to control their own reactions by avoidance or withdrawal. Okay? And it only heightens anxiety because distancing increases the separateness between the two people. Okay? And every system, every relationship will try to do one of these three. The other one is emotional fusion. This is being codependent. We get stuck together. It's like this. Anxiety is bound by pleasing or manipulating, or trying to manipulate the other person. The relationship may be stable at the time, but becomes less reliable as time goes on. And trust and mutual respect for each other diminish. Now, when I was working as a counselor, and people would come in for marital counseling, they came in with two issues, usually. They said, they'll come in, we're here, this is my husband, this is me, can you put us back together? Or they would come in like this, with no idea of sense of their separateness identities, and they're enmeshed, they're codependent on each other, can you split us apart? This was very difficult, by the way, getting into that. And then the other one is the emotional triangulation, the most common way to find anxiety. This is when I have an issue with somebody and I'll grab another party and bring them in. So instead of me dealing directly with somebody, I'll bring in a third party. And this is what people will do in periods of anxiety. This is, and they'll do it all the time. We do it, not they do. We do it all the time. We'll pick one of these three, okay? But there's a few things you need to remember about anxiety. Anxiety will not do you in. No matter how anxious or you become, it will not do you in. Anxiety is contagious. I mentioned that earlier.
Tim, can you talk a little bit about why it's contagious? What is there about it?
Good question. It is, well, the biggest example going on now is political stuff that's going on. And you would walk into an auditorium and even in this group here, if somebody came running in and was real anxious about something, all of a sudden we're going, really, what's going on? You know, stuff like that. And pretty soon, everybody's kind of falling into that. The other part about anxiety is related to this contagious. It also leads to mob rule. It's all of a sudden we're all together and we're all, and I'll talk about that about the brain too. But that's what I'm talking about. And you go to any of the conventions now, you're going, they're highly anxious. I mean, they're just anxiety when you walk in, as what is reported on the news and what you see is the video clips of what's going on. And I'm going, these people can't think reasonably, which I'll talk about the brain. Okay. Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And of course, none of us are caught in that at all. Okay. I mean, seriously, we aren't. And people will want to bind their anxiety. Okay, that I just basically. So those, if you just keep those three things in front of you, you'll have an idea about anxiety.
And what do you mean by bind?
I just, those three things, you're going to either, they're going to try to bind it by doing this, by separating themselves, emotional cutoff, or by codependent behavior, mm-hmm. or triangulation. The triangulation is you know, it, you have to understand, and you'll see it, once you know about that, you'll see it all the time, and you'll find yourself doing that. You know, I have an issue with you, I do, no I don't. So I may pull in somebody else. I may have an issue with my congregation. And when I pull in somebody else, either, you know, I end up complaining about them or I complain about you. Does that make sense? So basically, I'm going behind your back. I won't deal with you directly. Okay. By the way, I don't have an issue with you, I don't think, so I think we're okay. Does that make sense?
Is it always negative?
No, because triangulation also happens in the family. That's a good question. It'd be very positive. What's a common triangle that operates in a family all the time?
Your mom gets mad at you, so you talk to your dad.
That's a little on the negative side.
Siblings.
Mom, dad, the kids. Or three kids have their own triangle. I mean, every system has multiple triangles. I mean, you can sit down with a congregation, you know, in your head, and I would say sit down with them, and you could just identify, I mean, you know, the music director, the pastor, and the council president. Now that may be contentious, or it may be positive. It could be the pastor, the associate pastor, you know, council president, church president, whatever. Peter Steinke, who's been one of my mentors for decades, talks about, actually I was there when he presented their program, but there, he worked with this Episcopal church. I should have said, okay, Episcopal church in the Chicago area, and I went along because I was at a conference with him, as he presented his final report, but he was explaining to us that they have their lead pastor and they have their associate pastor, and the two of them have not talked directly to each other for over 20 years.
Wow.
They would not talk to each other, and so they had to go through other. So they would be sitting at a meeting across the table, and they would not even talk to each other. They would talk, somebody else was in talk.
So it would include mediation in a positive or a negative sense.
Yeah.
So you're using...
By the way, the congregation finally caught on and fired both of them.
So binding is a resolution to anxiety.
It is, and it's not a positive resolution.
Okay.
Yeah. So when I emotionally cut off, I'm not really dealing with you.
Yeah.
You know, and teenagers a lot of times emotionally cut off, or they try, because I don't want to deal with it. And that's a separateness. They just... And so you're in a, and it can happen in, during a board meeting, it can happen during a staff meeting, it can happen in a family. You mostly cut off, you know, I'm not going to deal with this, you know, and I may not say that, I just won't respond. Okay. But anxious people in anxious systems always seek one of three ways of binding their anxiety. Because if I don't have anything to bind, if I can't bind my anxiety with something, then I really might not have anxiety. I mean, anxiety is contagious. I have to grab onto something with it, or to some person, or it's no fun. It's no fun to have your own anxiety. You have to share it, so to speak. Yeah.
Tim, how would you define anxiety? The definition of it.
How would you define it?
I'm not even sure. You know it when you feel it, but
yes.
It's hard to know.
And what happens when you feel anxiety?
Well, your body reacts. Or,
yeah. You get tightness.
You get tightness.
Shortness of breath sometimes.
Yeah.
Worry. can't sleep.
Discomfort.
You start breaking out in sweat.
Yeah.
All that can happen. Each individual handles that differently. Now, positive anxiety, that first, you know, the ordinary anxiety may not just do that. I mean, for me, it's kind of running around yelling, Susan, not at Susan, but say, where's my keys? Where are my keys? Oh, they're right here in my hand. I mean, it's getting to that point. Can't find my wallet. Can't find my Fitbit. Can't find this, you know. And I gotta leave, and I'm lost, you know, and I'm going to miss the bus, or I'm going to miss the ferry, or I'm going to, you know, something like that. It's kind of this little bit. That's normal. That stuff happens every day. I can't find my shoe. I can't find, you know, so forth and so on. So your physical reaction to it's going to be different. Your physical reaction is going to be different than Bob's, different than mine, so forth and so on. But we all have it. We all have it. Anybody else?
I feel uncertainty about an outcome is where much of my anxiety may flow from. And I'm not sure, I guess I could try to bind myself with somebody who will reassure me of it turning out okay, but I'm not, that person may not be available.
And guess what? If that person isn't available and you're dealing with that anxiety about yourself, it probably, I would assume, it's going to be a motivation for you to do something. Correct?
Mm-hmm.
You know. Healthy anxiety, like when you lose a job, you know, some people will sit there and be depressed and won't be able to move because their anxiety has basically got them stuck for a while. And you might, if you've ever gone through that, you may have done that yourself. And then somewhere along the line, you kind of convince yourself that I need to be doing something. So, you know, I call up my friends and I start doing that networking and looking, you know, online for, you know, positions, something like that. So it's motivation, yes.
I'm sorry, you.
It was a tie, but okay, sure.
Where does stress, how is that similar to, different from?
Similar to and mostly similar to.
So what's the difference?
Not much. Anxiety could be, I mean, stress can, we react to our own personal stress differently. And part of that can be anxious times. When you feel stressed, you can also feel anxious. It happens to me all the time. So it's basically, you can almost, I don't know if you can actually interact both phrases, or interchange, excuse me. You know, interchange both phrases.
Yeah. Stress may lead to anxiety.
And stress can and probably will lead to anxiety. But anxiety won't do you in. In other words, it might stick you with that. You might get stuck for a while, but it won't do you in as if it's not going to. Stress can put you in the hospital. Anxiety probably won't. Yeah.
And what?
Hang on.
I'm wondering how anxiety disorders would fit in, because an anxiety disorder could
well, I guess it probably could.
And so I'm wondering how anxiety disorders might fit within this framework, and if it's that's a separate piece, that's fine too. But that's one of the.
Bill, would you like to answer that one? How does anxiety disorders fit into this?
Well, there are generalized anxiety disorders that are basically biochemical in nature and not precipitated by stressful events or whatever. Although those things can exacerbate the anxiety. Mm-hmm. But the treatment is therapy. There's all kinds of new therapies that are quite effective. And sometimes medication.
Some medication, yes.
Yeah. Panic is through the roof. Mm-hmm. That's with the fast heart rate, the shortness of breath, lightness of head, feelings of impending doom. People are really incapacitated by panic disorder.
Paranoia, if it's
there. And it's really not precipitated by necessarily anything.
Yeah.
They've been doing a lot of fine, all of a sudden panic disorder. And they really deserve a lot of attention. So it's about chemical versus what Tim is talking about, rather than situational. Yeah, the situation
can
precipitate itself, right?
But
so
this business, you know, so you sort of mentioned that it can be, something happens to cause you anxiety. Or,
sure.
And it seems to me that there's the kernel of the positive sense, you know, so like, you might have felt a little anxiety when you were walking in this room to do what you're doing, right?
Yeah.
Right now.
Yeah.
When I go teach a class, I typically do a little bit better job, I think, when I am a little bit anxious.
Yes, it's a great motivator.
Right? And so it's sort of this funny kind of a beast.
Yep.
Right? You gotta keep it under control, but it...
But it's gonna be there.
You could use the same stress, you could use the word stress or anxiety in those examples, too. Couldn't you feel a little stressed going into class?
Yeah, I suppose.
Anybody else?
There used to be studies out, I don't know if they're still current, but that people were going in for, say, open heart surgery. Mm-hmm. If they had a certain level of anxiety going in before the results were more positive, it was the people who were just, I don't care.
So,
so it does serve a positive purpose.
Stress hormones go up.
One of my favorite quotes is by Edmund Friedman, anxiety not resolved in one relationship will be played out in another relationship. Okay. So this leads us into the brain. Your brain on emotional energy. It's processed emotional by accepting and releasing electrical and chemical signals. I mean, this is all way up there. Different parts of your brain processes information differently. We know that. So I found what I think to be the best diagram on how our brain actually works. Let me see here. All right. You can see. All right. Here's the guy's ears, his eyes, down on the nose. This is inside of his head, and he has a little workman that goes around plugging in everything and unplugging everything. That's how your brain really works. Each of us has this little guy in there, or gal, walking around, plugging in all the electrical stuff. I can hear him sometimes. He speaks to me sometimes.
Does he ever say, whoops?
Yeah. A lot of times. A lot of times, actually. So, I like to use, and this is an oversimplification, but there's a Dr. Paul McLean who has a trying brain. Kind of religious, but that's not why I use it. It's just easy to explain. Okay, I find it. Human beings have what he calls three brains. We have the amygdala, yes, the reptilian brain. That's at the base of back here. It's about the size of a walnut or maybe your thumb. Okay, and you have the mammalian brain. That's the midbrain, and you have the neocortex, the primate, which is each of these areas. And they aren't, you can't open up somebody's skull and take off a layer saying that's your neocortex, this is your midbrain, this is your reptilian part of the brain. It isn't that easy. But for explaining this, this is how, you know, it helps. Because they do overlap and interconnect. And each function separately and uniquely, and they're all useful for our survival and our functioning. For instance, the amygdala brain, the reptilian part of the brain, this is automatic. This is instinctive. If we didn't have this, you people would be dead. We would all be dead. Okay. It fires fast and it endures. It endures. It is about our safety, our self-preservation. It doesn't think or feel. It just reacts. In other words, if you didn't have this part of your brain and you stepped off a curve, and also you see a vehicle coming at you, you know, if you had this, you'd quickly get out of the way. Otherwise, if you didn't have this, you'd go, is that a big truck or a mid-sized truck? Is it a Ford or a Chevy? Is it going, you know, you'd sit there and try to analyze the whole thing, meanwhile you get run over. Or if a ball's coming at your head, is that a Wilson or a Spalding? You know, you just don't do that, you just react. And if you didn't have it, you wouldn't be here. It is timeless and is ritualistic. There is no variation to the response to a specific stimuli. In other words, if a car's coming at you, you're probably going to get out of the way. The next time a car comes at you, guess what? You're going to get out of the way if you're fast enough. All right? Does that make sense?
What do you mean by ritualistic?
Over and over again. Okay? It doesn't think. It doesn't emote. It doesn't rationalize. It's there to protect you. It's called, by many, the reptilian brain, because reptiles don't think, they don't emote, they eat their young, they walk over their young, you know, and they just react. Okay? They don't really have much of a brain. Okay, does that make sense? So this part of the brain, if it's removed in a human being or altered in any way, they will not be able to survive. The mammalian brain or the midbrain is our emotional center. The area that processes and stores our feelings. This part of the brain ties things together. You can connect the dots. It is timeless. You can do it over and over and over again. It's part of our playfulness, our nurturing. It is about our connection to others. This part of the brain allows you to be together in Holden Village. This part of the brain that has been altered in scientific studies or removed in animals that tend to herd, they no longer can herd. They cannot take care of their young. Because this is the part that is about nurturing. This is the part, you know, that gets you group, gets you to herd. So we herd in our groups. If we didn't have that, we would have no idea, no concept or whatever about being together. It'd be very difficult. It allows a sense of community and a sense of relationships. And the mammalian part of the brain, this middle part of the brain, creates relationships three ways. It gives us the capacity to bond or connect, and I already talked about removing that and so forth. It gives us the capacity to play, to be spontaneous, and it gives us the capacity to feel. Now, in scripture, this whole bit about bonding and connectedness, in the Old Testament, there are over 400 references in the Old Testament to the face of God. Isaiah talks about how long are you going to hide your face from me, O Lord. We also have the Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you, be gracious to you. So there's this connectedness. And some scientists believe that this connectedness in a healthy relationship, when one of the spouses or that healthy relationship dies, the other one dies shortly thereafter. Part of that is believed because they've lost that mirror. We mirror in our relationships. We get that feedback all the time from our relationships. That's why people in relationships tend to live longer than people that aren't in relationships. I believe that's true. Everything that keeps popping up says that. You know, it's a good reason to stay married or to stay connected. You'll live longer. 400 references to the face of God in the Old Testament alone. Then we get to the neocortex. This is the thinking center for problem solving, decision making, understanding. It's where our memory is stored. It's where we organize our world. It's where we find clarity. So the lower brain is about safety. The midbrain is about connectedness. The neocortex is about clarity. And you see in that little diagram how large that is. It houses our speech, our imagination, and our creativity. It's our beliefs, values, and convictions. I'm going to go back for a bit to the midbrain about the play. You know, that midbrain, and I forgot to bring this up. I apologize about that, but that midbrain, thinking back to the other part, allows us to be spontaneous and to play. And studies have found that if we don't play, we tend to become violent. We tend to push, hit, jab, kick, bite, shout, stab, verbally lash out, and so forth and so on. And of course, my question is, what do schools tend to do away with first in their program?
Recess.
Right? When I was growing up, we had three recesses. We had a morning recess, we had after lunch recess, which means we didn't eat much, but we ran outside to play, and then we had an afternoon recess. And the punishment was, you didn't go out for recess. You know, wow. Okay, so part of it, same back about the midbrain, and that happens because there's no imagination, there's no creativity. Recess and play stimulates our imagination, right? And stimulates their creativity. And of course, studies have found that the more creative a child is, the less violent that they tend to be. All right. Sorry about that. I had to go ahead and bring that one up. All right, so the neocortex. Now, it is what separates us from the other species of animals, our reasoning and our thinking. The neocortex makes up approximately 85% of our brain. Together, the amygdala, I can never pronounce that, the reptilian or the mammalian or the midbrain make up only 15%. But they fire quicker. And they can be driven for hours. That's where you get mob rule. Okay. Do you remember a gentleman by the name of Bernard Goetz? Remember that? Bernard Goetz? What did Bernard Goetz do? The date is 1984.
Kill people.
Go on.
I don't remember the details, but it was nasty, ugly, brutish, and terrible.
Well, most murders are. Actually, he didn't murder anybody, he just shot people.
No. Wasn't it on
a
subway?
Subway, yeah.
He's on subway, and he's sitting there, and he has a gun. And four black youths get up and start coming at him. Later, they would admit to the fact that they were going to mug him. Okay. He pulls out a gun, he shoots all four. Okay, they survive. The lawyers all thought, I mean, what he was brought up about was that the prosecutor felt that he could have been more rational, because as they're waiting there for the police to arrive, the subway stops waiting for the police to arrive, he shoots him again. Mm-hmm. He's just sitting there, they're sprawled out, he goes around and shoots him again. Okay. So, the prosecutor thought he should be more rational, the defense countered with a neurosurgeon, with a brain specialist, and said, just what I have been saying. This, you know, his anxiety went up, it fired off, and it kept going, and he had no sense of doing that. Another example, Rwanda, a number of years ago, decades ago, during Clinton, they had that, you know, massacre between the two tribes going on. And when they brought people to trial, several of them, in all honesty, could not remember doing those murders. Because as mob rule, they got to a certain level of anxiety, and it fired and kept going. And they had, even though they're shown on, you know, some tapes, you know, taking a machete to somebody, they had no recollection of doing it. Okay. Doesn't excuse them for what they did, but anyway. So, any questions on this so far?
Can you describe mob rule a little bit?
No. Yeah. Well, mob rule is when somebody says, I mean, you watch it in movies, you see it on the TV bit, and when one or two people just come in and start antagonizing and whipping everybody up, you know, to where they're no longer being rational. So rational, you know, you're rational when you can think, and people in mob rule don't think, they just react. Okay, they just react. And it could be very nasty, to say the least. Now we're going to do a little experiment. This is my experiment. Yeah. I'm going to ask you four questions. I'm going to ask them in rapid order, and I want you to answer as quickly as you can. Okay? Everybody ready? And I need to have you shout out the answers. Okay. So I'm going to ask you some questions. And I want you to answer as quickly as you can, all right? What color is this?
Wait.
What color is this?
White.
What color is this?
White.
What do cows drink?
Yeah.
All right, how many of you almost said white? Yeah, it's kind of in there. Cows drink water. They don't drink milk.
calves do drink milk.
By definition, a calf is a calf. By definition, a cow is a female bovine. It could be a hippo, it could be a rhinoceros, it could be a cattle, it could, you know. But see, right then, in that short little explanation, your brain went off a different way. There's a name for that. And Susan, you're looking a little like, what?
Did you say calves drink water?
No. A calf is a calf. The question was, what do cows drink? A cow is a female bovine.
Okay. You know, they drink water.
They drink water. But your brain is called special activation or spending activation. This is when the mind activates in directions that flow in inappropriate areas. In other words, your brain took you on a trip because of those questions. Mm-hmm. In the spreading activation, the mind unquestionably leaps from one thing to another. And something activates one thing in our minds, which then leads us down a wrong path. And quickly, I was able to get you to do that, go down the wrong path. Now, I don't know how anxious you felt going into this little exercise, but it just shows you how quickly the brain can, hello, I'm going over here. Okay.
What happens if our brain does that a lot?
I'm sorry, what?
What happens if our brain does that a lot?
Yeah, next question. Our brains do it all the time, I think. I mean, it happens to me and then you have to put yourself back.
But some people, I think, can control it better.
Well, in a real simple form, they call it jumping to a conclusion, which doesn't necessarily follow, but some people do that all the time. They get one clue and they try to answer the question. Mm-hmm. And that's where it can be dangerous, or maybe it's just silly. But
I would say as I get older, I find myself that happening to me more.
Is that right?
So I'm wondering what that leads to, but...
See, when our brain becomes highly stressed, you know, it's we revert to the reptilian brain real quickly. Okay. Now, in this case, you didn't necessarily go to the reptilian brain. Your brain just took you down a path.
Well, kind of set that the stress you put on us was the hurry, hurry, hurry.
Yeah.
And that contributes to it, too.
Yeah. I've had people say, you know, I felt a little anxious before it even started, you know. Now, a way that you get yourself or people out of that anxiety and that reptilian and the midbrain kind of anxiety stuff that can drive you know, different ways. There's two ways, and Jesus was a good example of this. I mean, seriously, some of the most anxious characters in Scripture are the disciples, crying that way. You know, they're always arguing about who's going to be first, and they're always worried about where we're going to get food, and what are you doing with this crowd, and blah, 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 and their anxiety's up. And Jesus did two things. He told stories, and he asked questions. Now, why would that work?
It interrupts the anxious brain cycle, the spreading activation cycle.
Correct. And it moves you from the lower brain and the midbrain back to the neocortex, which is your part of reason. That's where you reason, make clarity, so forth and so on. So that's what he would do to get them to try to think more rationally. Okay. So when you are faced in, if you find yourself in an anxious situation, you can ask yourself, am I being reactive? Or am I being, I should have said that word first. Okay, I'll put that in a second. But now my anxiety just went up. Not really, but. Or am I being, I'll think about it, get back to you. Am I being reactive or am I being not responsive? Let me see if I can find it real quick.
Proactive.
I'm sorry, what?
Proactive.
That can work.
Intentional.
Oh, am I, am I being reactive or? Can't find it right now. I might have to make an announcement at dinner. Anyway,
so different question.
Go right ahead.
Related. So spreading activation isn't always bad, right? So if you have lots of links between different things in long-term memory, and somebody pushes a button, and then those links are going to go into action and they're going to pop in all sorts of things into your brain and bring it into, you know, like working memory immediately, right? But that can be bad or good, you know? So somebody might say welfare and you think about black person, well, that's bad, right? I mean, it's spreading activation and it's bad.
Uh-huh.
But if someone, I mean, you know, you can think of spreading activation being you know, positive associations as well as negative associations and the rest. I mean, I get it, but I mean, it's...
Reflective, I mean, thank you.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that's the other word.
Yeah.
Okay, so are you being reflective or are you being reactive? And I've had people, when I was doing therapy work and this, I'm sorry, Bob, I...
No, but that's it. Right.
Okay. So, and they would actually, especially young mothers, if I remember correctly, would put those two words on their refrigerator. So when they start getting anxious with all the screaming kids and stuff like that, they ask themselves, you know, am I being reflective or am I being reactive? Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. And they can catch themselves with it. By just asking that question in their head, they've already moved back to the neocortex. Okay. I'm sorry, Bob, did I answer your question?
No, actually that's part of it, but it's just the idea that part of it depends what the links are in your yeah. memory, right? You know, and what you're associating with what. And so it can create, I mean, you know, there are a lot of prejudices that people can bring to bear through spreading activation, but there are also, you know, positive sorts of things that come.
Yeah, I would agree. Anybody else?
Aren't most of the decisions that we make on a minute-to-minute, day-to-day basis just instantaneous without thinking at all? They just, and that's influenced by our experience, probably by our intuition a bit, but also by just, we see something and we respond to it, because we always have, and that's the way it always is. So in a way, I don't think it's either reflective or it's reactive. I think it just is.
And that's because of your history and what you do. And, you know, if you're a surgeon, you know what to do. And, you know, you don't have to necessarily sit there. And you can be very anxious about the operation, but you also feel very comfortable with the operation because I've done this 135 times. You know, I've been successful twice, but we're getting better. Is that what you kind of like?
You walk outside the sunshine, you put on your sunglasses. You don't think about it, you just do it.
No, that's right. By the way, one of the best books, Brainworks, a national bestseller by John Medina. I highly recommend it. It doesn't go into big detail on how your brain works, but he does, this is the type of work he does. And he's not a surgeon, but he studies the brain. I can't even remember his long title. I've heard him speak once. He was very engaging. Most of the time you think people like this are very boring, but they're not. And it was a national bestseller. He also has Brainworks for parents, so that they can understand what's going on with their children, especially when they're, you know, not quite been delivered yet. And, you know, all this bit about playing music, Beethoven will make them, no, it does not work. All this talking and stuff like that does not really work, you know, to the pregnant, you know, child and stuff.
Part of the answer, too, is I would think would be this, well, this is where maybe stimulus and response works a little bit, because we get into patterns of behavior based on experience we've had before, and it triggers us, and if we're thirsty, we get a drink of water, and there's usually not much stress unless we're in the desert.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of behaviors that don't get this sophisticated.
No, this is just what happens if.
Yeah.
If your anxiety goes down like that. He also points out, most brain studies show that, we always say, well, I'm multitasking.
Tasking.
And the brain does not multitask. Right. It just does not. You know, and everybody says, oh, I'm multi. Well, call it what you want, but your brain ain't involved with that, you know, so that's one. Your brain continues to grow until you die, unless it's inhibited by smoking and drugs and alcohol. It kind of dies a little earlier, so forth. And, it used to be that when you got to be 20, they said 27, 29, then your brain is complete and da da da. No, the brain keeps growing and growing and growing until you die. It does very well in repairing itself too, to brain injuries.
Old people can get good ideas. It's really cool.
Two or three. Yeah. Say that again, I didn't hear you. Mary.
Well, it seems. To me, I mean, listening to, Gary said, most of what we just do.
I have it, yeah.
And, but the example you gave, to me, showed that the need for, the pressure for speed was what really messed it up. I mean, if you had given me those four questions while I was drinking a cup of coffee in the morning, I probably would have answered them correctly.
Correct.
Or at least a lot better chance. So I guess I'm just wondering, you know, and it's like when I was working, you know, I said, gee, I wish I could be like a Supreme Court judge and have these very complicated decisions to make, but have as much time almost as I want to make them, whereas my job, you had to make decisions really quickly. And so I guess I'm wondering where this need for speed, or I don't know, where does that fit in, or?
Go ahead, Bill.
Well, I don't know if it's speed, but I think it's stimulation.
Say that louder.
I think it's more stimulation. We're exposed to so much stimulation. And you're right, we don't think about things, but it does impact ourselves, because in grabbing for this and grabbing for that and listening to this and looking at that, we're going to make mistakes, or we're going to forget something that we saw instantaneously on social media. So the opposite of that is some of the current therapies are the mindfulness. Mm-hmm. Slow down.
Yeah.
Think, meditate, cognitive behavioral. We talk about cognition up there. Thinking up through, evaluating. We do that with adolescents. There's CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy. Stop, think, then act. I mean, it's simple, but it's absolutely important, because I think that we've always been exposed to stimuli, but in this day and age,
it's just
so much more. And we like to think we have more control over it, but I really don't think we do, because it's coming at us wherever we turn.
Correct.
So you could say speed and high stimulation adds to the anxiety of our age.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm a little anxious about retirement. You know, I'm not going to retire for a while longer, because I'm anxious about it. And I can read everything you want about it. And we have tons of books, and, you know, we have resources at our fingertips, internet, so forth and so on. I'm still anxious about it, you know, but I don't think I move out of the neocortex very much, because we're always asking each other questions about that, you know. And so I'm not going down the wrong path when it comes to that, I don't believe, you know. But I'm anxious about it. It's just part of my life.
And that's normal.
The book Daniel Kahneman, The Thinking Fast and Slow.
Mm-hmm. I've heard of it.
I mean, and this came out of, he's a economist, but it's mostly the it's a psychology of the kinds of decision making that is done by people who deal with a lot of money.
Yeah.
Because they do it all the time, and they have to get it right most of the time.
Yeah.
And but I think everything that's in there points out that most of the decisions that we make are not done with slow thinking, they're done with fast thinking.
Correct.
They're mostly correct. They mostly get us by. We might get the cow and the milk and the water wrong. But for the most part, that's how we live our lives. And
yeah.
It's just, as we have grown up and matured, we just learn how to do that.
Yeah.
Culturally, this is driven a lot of times by competition. Our society gets more competitive, and you have to win, and the fastest is the best, and the quickest is the smartest, and all of that becomes part of the background noise of who we are as people very often.
Mm-hmm. Sure, a little cartoon with you. It says, I thought it might be an appropriate time to give a sermon on anger. So, keys to dealing with anxiety when you are faced with it. It all depends on your response, basically. When other people around you are very anxious, are you mature? Not in age-wise, not, you know, but can you respond to these people, okay, by continuing to be yourself? Can you regulate your own anxiety? There's a book, it was out a long time ago, I think it was called The Hospital or something like that. And in it, it's kind of like what goes on in the hospital, and here's the characters and stuff. But they had a list of 10 things to do, or eight things to do when there is a code red. And the third thing on the list was take your own pulse. If you're responding, take your own pulse. Can you regulate your anxiety during that sort of a thing? See, are you reactive or reflective? That's what I was looking for. Now, can you not allow another's anxiety or behavior to determine who you are? You know, those emotional binding type of things. Can you take a stand? Do you use I statements? And can you stay connected, able to relate with persons who don't agree with you? Unfortunately, in the political scene we have nowadays, I don't think that's not happening too often, as I can see it. But. And there's a wonderful other resource that I have used quite often, and I can't remember where I picked it up, learned it, whatever. But when somebody is really upset with me, I'm not talking about Susan, usually in the parish that I'm serving now, I'll always get somebody coming through the door, and all, or you know, and they're just. And when somebody is, when you're facing somebody like that, don't explain, don't defend, and don't justify. All right? You know why? If somebody's really angry with you, what part of the brain they're in?
They're not listening.
They're not going to listen. You can justify what you said. You can explain it. They're not listening. Okay? So don't try. So, again, what two things can you do?
Tell a story.
Listen or tell a story.
There. You tell a story, or they, ask them to tell a story. Or ask them a question, because you have to move them towards the neocortex part of the brain.
Yeah, the current political thing, you think about this, both Sanders and Trump are using anxiety to maintain their following, in a sense, or to get the mob stirred up, and which is interesting that you see it. The tool can be used by either purveyor of the tool.
Oh, yeah. You know, to me, the best thing that the Clinton people can do is, and I think she does it fairly well, but I stopped paying attention. But I think she just kind of maintains that non-anxious aspect of her. Doesn't shout, doesn't raise her voice, but she, you know, she'll explain things, and she doesn't react right away. She doesn't tweet like Donald Trump does. And, you know, and yeah, the way he reacts to things just scares the heck out.
But why are there so many people, or are they just coming to the fore, that are living in this reptilian definition? I mean, if we...
Stampeded, so you go.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, because I agree, I feel there are many people that I cannot explain, defend, justify, or, you know, we often talk about showing the facts.
Yeah.
None of those,
they
don't care.
They're not at that point.
But, I mean, is this that they've always been there? Or, I mean, what is it that has made them leave their neocortex and go to their...
It's an election year. We always leave our neocortex.
That's interesting.
And react. It is. It's sad.
There's a lot of change afoot, and a lot of people have lost in the last decade. Mm-hmm. And so that contributes to it, too, I think.
Well, we also have to blame somebody for where we are.
Yeah.
I think there are people who have been... I mean, they have been traumatized.
Yeah.
And this is what happens. I mean, it's like, if you give somebody a cancer diagnosis, they traumatize the heck out of them, and you don't do any of these things here. You just, it doesn't work. You know?
Yeah.
You're not going to listen to that kind of thing.
Not at that time. They may be able to listen later, you know. So, another way is you speak the truth in love to anxious people. There's another, and I haven't really used it, but I find it, Rob Voile, out of the Center for Clergy Leadership, does appreciative inquiry, tons of that type of it. He does webinars, and he talks on in one about, you remember that TV series back in the 60s and 70s about, I think the guy, gentleman's name was Kane, and he was a Buddhist monk going from town to town and, you know, fighting.
Cowboy?
Was that it?
It was in Cowboy Days. Yeah.
What's it called?
It was Western.
It was a Western, but he was a Buddhist monk.
Oh my gosh.
Remember him?
Yeah.
Remember that? Yeah.
No.
And the way he would take, and this is actually a Buddhist method of doing this, when somebody comes in very anxious and blames you for something, and the Buddhist way of doing this, he explains, is you put your hands together like this, and you agree with him, but you go like this. You are absolutely correct. I was wrong, even though it may work. But you do that.
because that already starts to bring down their anxiety. But what you're doing is you're protecting the gut, the most vulnerable, and you're putting the hardest part of your body in front of them. That's your forehead right here. So that's what you do. You just kind of go, you are absolutely correct. I did that inappropriately or something like that.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? I would have never thought of that. Someday I'm going to use it. But I can't use it at home because Susan just told me to.
I think, you know, it's instinctual from the standpoint when we see children that are having anxiety, we hold them and hug them and comfort them.
Yeah.
But somehow we're taught we can't do that with adults. And maybe that's another good response too.
Well, I think it would be.
Yeah.
Mutual conversation with one another makes one powerful, makes both people powerful with that mutual conversation. But it has to start with the fact you have to move that part, or yourself, for that matter, has to be in that neocortex part of it where you can think and you can reason. You can name the demon. You know, that's how Jesus took the power out of, in Mark, the demon that was in that, and then he called and he asked the demon, what's your name?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Legion.
Yeah, Legion. Yeah, and then he drives him, you know. But by doing that, you name the demon. In other words, what's the issue? You name it. And that also helps. Forgiveness works. But it only works when the person is out of that anxiety, or, you know, then they can actually hear it and they can feel it and stuff. So, prayer. Because the more anxious you are, the less spiritual you're going to be. Does that make sense? You're not alone. God is in the midst of all that happens. And then I have the more reactive, the less spiritual resources are used. Okay. So it is now 4:01 p.m. Any questions? Hope this was helpful. I'm going to show you two of my favorite cartoons. Mm-hmm. Has nothing to do with what we're doing. John has decided to follow Jesus. Now this was used in a stewardship campaign, a congregation. You know, John has decided to follow Jesus. Kind of reluctantly. And then I like this one too. This one reads, I hate Sunday. I hate the Sunday when we switch to daylight saving time. Okay. All right. That's it. Any other questions? Any go to the order?
Thank you. Can you move it back
2 slides,
please?
Sure.
Yeah, thanks.
Right. Okay, that's fine. I'll leave it there for a while. No problem. If you have any questions about it. By the way, if anybody wants any of this stuff, I'll put it into a paper form. You email me and I'll be happy to send you all the notes. Mm-hmm. I have no problem with that. So, have a non-anxious evening. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.